Good morning, everyone. Saturday, July 11th, a few seconds past 8 o'clock here in the newsroom in New York. Here is a roundup of developments at home and abroad, for which we call in members of our foreign staff and Earl Godwin in our nation's capital. First to the Middle East, to Cairo, for the report of Grant Parr.
Hello, New York.
This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. Moving westward before dawn, west of the Alamein Box, Dominion troops yesterday launched an attack which rolled the Germans back 5 miles. The fighting went on all day yesterday on an extensive scale, and it's most likely that it is still going on today. The immediate objective of the British was the railway station west of Alamein, and they reached this during the day. In the process of the limited hard-fought advance, the Allies captured a number of Italian prisoners. The British advance apparently began along the railway line, which places it just a few miles south of the coast. This is the area where the German 90th Light Infantry was stationed a few days ago before New Zealand attacks in the south drew this cracked German unit down to reinforce Italian infantry on the other German flank. By attacking where and when they did, the British were able to draw forward against positions which, unless recently reinforced, are held mainly by Italian infantry and artillery. The bulk of the German infantry and artillery was in the center of the area between Alamein and the escarpment, and the bulk of the Nazi armored forces was further back. It's not yet certain whether the tank sections of the two panzer divisions have been engaged yet, but it is possible. Although the British advance has thus far been mostly an infantry operation, the troops have had the support of tanks. On the southern part of the front, enemy forces continued an eastward movement started several days ago. They were engaged by British columns, which destroyed several Axis tanks. In all-out efforts to aid and protect both British and Dominion troops, Royal Air Force fighters made a record number of sorties against any enemy positions in the battle area. It's not considered advisable to give figures on such sorties, as the enemy uses them to estimate the number of planes we are using. But knowing that yesterday set a record, you will have some idea of the size of operations then if I tell you what happened on a certain unspecified day in the past. On that day, 130 bombers, escorted by 127 fighters, attacked enemy concentrations southwest of Alamein. 75 Kitty Hawk bombers attacked transport at El Daba Aerodrome. 166 Spitfire and Hurricane fighters carried out sweeps at hourly intervals over the battle area. At night, 84 Wellingtons, 8 Liberators, and 6 Blenheims raided truck groups at El Daba and tipping at Benghazi. Yesterday, British bombers again attacked at El Daba, but this time their targets were enemy warplanes. Several Axis machines were damaged or put out of action altogether. 8 Axis fighters were shot down in the desert yesterday. 19 were destroyed over Malta in 2 days. And during the same period, we lost 13 machines. In the opinion of Major General Charles L. Scott, senior American military observer here, nothing would so aid Allied forces in the Middle East as the immediate supply of a great number of large-caliber, high-velocity anti-tank guns. We're all happy to hear General Scott say, America is now manufacturing such guns. Guns which may even surpass the fine German 88-millimeter weapon that has been so destructive to Allied tanks in the present battle. This is Grant Parr in Cairo, returning you to New York.
In the British capital, where it's a few minutes past 2 in the afternoon, John McVeigh is ready to report. Go ahead, London.
This is London. Military circles in London believe that General Auchinleck made the first thrust in the new fighting in Egypt. Rommel's attack in the south seems to have been launched later. Both attacks, as seen from here, were made independently of each other. It's said here that Rommel's main forces aren't concentrated at the point in the north where Auchinleck's men attacked. The British haven't broken through any enemy lines for the simple reason that there aren't any lines. The average Britisher today, looking at Egypt and Russia, is taking a very serious view of the war. He'd laugh at you if you told him there was any real possibility of the United Nations losing the war. On the other hand, he sees no sign anywhere that a quick Allied victory is going to be possible. At the moment, he's thinking in terms of years rather than months. Sometimes the Englishman is inclined to think the Americans haven't yet realized the grimness of the job that lies ahead of us. The other day, British newspapers quoted an American congressman talking about the war ending in 1942. This made the British remember those early days of the war when most people hoped that by the blockade, the Maginot Line, and the limited use of manpower, the war could be won, perhaps sometime in 1940. It made the British feel also that some Americans don't realize that crisis is a mild word for the present situation of the United Nations, and it's going to take a long time and every bit of the man and woman power we can exert to win the war. This week, too, the papers were printing stories, later denied, that an American general had all but been chosen as Supreme Commander of the United Nations. This seemed to some observers here, although they were too polite to say so, almost flippant. How one man could command Russia, China, the Middle East, Britain, and all other fronts from Washington would be a problem. The thing here is that Britain should develop better generals. General Wavell and General Auchinleck command a good deal of respect, but so far the war hasn't developed any single great British commanding genius. One comment on the subject came from the waitress in a restaurant where I was having lunch. She was discussing the Battle of Libya. Then out of the blue, she said with a laugh, "I wonder why we don't take £5 million and get Rommel on our side." There are plenty of men with brains in the British Army. War correspondents meet them from time to time. They may rank as majors, colonels, or generals, but it will take campaigning to give them a real chance to show what they can do. The fighting that our own American Army has done so far hasn't given our generals a chance to prove themselves in handling large bodies of men. Except for the carefully planned defense of Bataan, we haven't engaged in any major actions on land. So to tell someone like Timoshenko, who's been conducting the biggest battle in history, that he'd have to act under the orders of a commander who hasn't handled big armies under fire would hardly seem good military sense. In time, the millions of men now training at home will probably be fighting on three continents. When that happens, if we have commanders of genius, they'll have plenty of chance to prove it to the rest of the world. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Yes, that was John McVane giving us a report from the British capital in London. And now we span another ocean as we switch from our New York newsroom to our reporter in Australia for news of the Far East situation. Go ahead, Australia.
This is Martin Abransky with General MacArthur's headquarters. I had a long talk today with one of our colonels just back from prolonged command duty at one of our most advanced operational bases. He gave some interesting sidelights on the way our doughboys have adapted themselves to a tropical climate and surroundings that, until the war brought our troops to Australia, were judged practically unlivable for the average white man. The predominant features of the countryside, according to the colonel, were the thick dust, the never-ending heat, the flies, and the mosquito. In some places, there were a scrubby sort of gum tree forest, and very occasionally a bit of grass. The unit the colonel commanded in this area were, for the most part, men with fairly short service terms behind them, mostly draftees and comparatively green to the art of warfare. Today, says the colonel, these men are as well-trained a bunch as our average regular army outfit and tough enough to do a 3 days forced march on emergency rations in heat that would knock out the average healthy civilian in about 1 hour flat. While under the direct command of American Army officers, this particular unit is one of the few in Australia which works under the higher command of an Australian general. The Australian, as the colonel described him to me, is not what you'd call a sissy, either. It's his habit to leave the paperwork to his subordinates and get out in the field with the men. He's become a familiar and respected figure to our doughboys, turning up among them at any odd time in a jeep in which he sits casually, sticking to his seat without a bounce on the roughest kind of ground, as if he were enjoying a pleasant drive in the country. To our soldiers, he's known as General T, not because T is his initial, but because he never moves without a tiny Prima stove on which he can make his afternoon tea. It's apparently a never-ending source of astonishment to our doughboys to see the general, after field exercises in blazing heat, which leaves everyone gasping for breath and something cold to drink, get his little stove set up to cook a boiling hot cup of tea. One moment, please. Here is a last-minute bulletin which has just been released in Australia. A few minutes ago, on the Australian broadcasting system, it was announced that Prime Minister John Curtin has just announced that elements of the Australian Imperial Forces, which remained in the Middle East, form part of the considerable reinforcement that has been made to the strength of the Eighth Army in Egypt. Mr. Curtin said that according to information which has reached the commander of Allied land forces in Australia, General Blamey, Australian infantry patrols went into action in the Egyptian desert on the night of July 7th to 8th. The patrols destroyed a number of German guns, gun tractors, and carriers, and took 9 prisoners. Australian casualties, Mr. Curtin said, were slight. This is Martin Nagronsky signing off now from somewhere in Australia.
Now a report on events here at home from Earl Godwin in Washington.
Good morning, folks. For years past, we have been favored, and I give a low bow to the news from the AP in Berlin when we used to get it. Louis Lochner, who was chief of the Associated Press Bureau in Berlin for the past 17 years, is in this country now and says Hitler is slipping and that someday the crash is bound to come. Lochner, speaking at Charlottesville, Virginia, to one of those institutes that they hold down there, says that this crash will not happen unless every man and woman and child in this country gets behind Uncle Sam with the greatest effort the world has ever known. In other words, Hitler may be a slipping giant, but he's still big enough to hurt us if he falls on us. Hitler does face serious problems in Germany, says this expert Associated Press newsman, Louis Lochner. But nevertheless, we must be unrelenting in our efforts to inflict a smashing blow upon the Hitler regime because, crippled or not, if we don't look out, he can lick us yet. And here's an interesting story. It's got a little humor to it, too. The Massachusetts Commissioner of Agriculture, whose name is Louis Webster, reports a decrease in egg production, and he blames it on the war. And he says it is because the hens, ever on the alert for overhead birds of prey, are easily alarmed by low-flying aircraft. The approach of planes starts a barnyard panic. Chickens are trampled and smothered. In short, they give a good demonstration of what not to do in an air raid, and the chickens, they are madder than a wet hen, and wouldn't that jar you at being somebody's alibi for an increase in the price of eggs? The Federal Reserve Board indicates that we are doing a good work and a great work to beat the Axis. A report just out shows that half the nation's factory output is war material, and the board says that the percentage is expected to go still higher. And of all of the durable goods produced, 70% are going toward the war effort. Battling Don Nelson, chief of the War Production Board, speaking in Detroit, tells several hundred automobile manufacturers that every manufacturer from now on must plan toward greater production with much less material for years to come. Plan for a long war, urges Nelson, and maybe it'll be a short war. That means the bigger the stick, the shorter the fight. And I think that's been the ruling passion with Congress, to make the appropriations so big that we'll have enough to last in a 5-year war, but so terrific and tremendous that we'll end the war in about 2 years. That scrap rubber drive ends. Yesterday was the closing day, but a new drive is on. The government wants scrap steel this time. Anything made of steel. And don't forget those tin cans and bacon drippings, which you're asked to save. More talk about relieving East Coast oil shortage. Transportation Director Eastman says he may take over oil barges from the Great Lakes area to help this, and that's all from Washington at this time.
These were reports of Grant Parr from Cairo, John McVane from London, Martin Nagronsky from Australia, and Earl Godwin from Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.